What did he call it? A headline service.
I never forgave him for that.
Yeah. You don't buy that, I gather.
No, I really don't. And I think what Walter was doing is, Walter Cronkite, was, I think he got it wrong. The fact is, let's go back to what we were saying a minute ago, that the different media do different things extremely well. And one of the things that television does is it shows you pictures of things that probably happened that afternoon, maybe that morning. And I think that Mears and I added up just this afternoon the number of words that go into a nightly newscast, and it came out to be only about 3,000 words. But if you also add what I regard as a very useful adage, and that is that a picture is worth 1,000 words, then you begin into a different kind of dynamics in terms of describing a television newscast that goes on for a half an hour. And you're not only, you're giving them two levels of signals at once. One signal is that what the anchorman or the reporters are reporting in, one hopes, English. And the other are all these pictures that keep coming back. Now, are the pictures important? Well, I know more academics who've written long books about the television coverage of the Vietnam War, and they weren't talking about the words as often as they're talking about the pictures. And so I think we have to acknowledge that it's more than a headline service. I readily acknowledge its imperfection. But I do know that it's more than just somebody sitting there reading 3,000 words, which would put you to sleep.
That was NBC commentator John Chancellor, who was joined by Walter Mears, the Washington bureau chief for the Associated Press. They're co-authors of a new book called The News Business, and they were featured at an author's rap session recorded in March at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. They were joined by moderator Betty Wasson and two fellow journalists, Marianne Means, a columnist at the Hearst Newspapers, and Stephen McCormick, editor-in-chief of the National News Service. The show was produced by Bruce Kellerman of National Public Radio with technical direction by Gary Henderson. Support for that broadcast was provided by the NPR News and Information Fund. Contributors include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, RKO General for Radio and Television Broadcasting, for the coverage of science, the National Science Foundation, and Hewlett-Packard, worldwide manufacturer of computers and instrumentation for industry and science. That program was a production of National Public Radio, which was solely responsible for its content. This is Fresh Air. It's 13 minutes after 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. With me back for a return visit to Fresh Air is Paul Zimmerman, who wrote the screenplay for the new film The King of Comedy, which stars Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis and is directed by Martin Scorsese. This is the first film produced from one of Zimmerman's scripts. In the 1970s, he was film critic for Newsweek. He now lives in Bucks County, where he's active in the nuclear freeze movement. He last joined us in the winter before King of Comedy was released. King of Comedy will be opening the Cannes Film Festival, which begins on May 7th. And Paul Zimmerman, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love the movie, and it's great to see you again.
Thank you, Terry. Those are the only conditions on which I'd returned. If you had had any kind of mixed feelings, I'm afraid I wouldn't have been able to make it.
Well, we got that straight. Let me ask you to describe the movie in your words.
Oh, it's fabulous. No, I would say basically, it's very hard to classify. I've had this problem when people ask me, is it a comedy? No, it's not exactly a comedy, although it's funny. Is it a melodrama? Yes, it's melodramatic, but it's more than that. It's a satire. I would say basically, if you had to classify it, and I don't see that you really do, it's more satire than anything else. It's a movie. It's a story with a lot of different tones and colors in it, and it's a story about a guy who's willing to give up several years of his life at least for 10 minutes on a Tonight-type talk show to do his 10 minutes of stand-up comedy. And for him, it's a question of whether he's ever going to exist publicly or not. It's really a matter of life and death for him. And Bob De Niro plays the hero, Rupert Pupkin, who absolutely must have his moment in the limelight. And Jerry Lewis plays the national talk show host who says, call my office, when first importuned by De Niro. De Niro takes that as his success being assured, lives the rest of his life as though he already is the king of comedy, and does what he has to get on. I don't think it's a secret by now that he winds up kidnapping Jerry Lewis Langford in the film. And as a last act of desperation. Will that do? Is that an adequate summary?
Yes. Did you ever want to be a comedian?
Oh, I still do. I mean, it's wonderful in as a fantasy of being able to stand up there with all that attention, say anything you want about anything, make people laugh and applaud. And I mean, it's a very seductive kind of fantasy, and one that's less seductive when you do it, as I did recently on the David Letterman show, to a hostile group of people who were born after 1975. No, actually, they were most of them in their early teens. Which is one of the surprises. You don't you can try and think of everything. I did my material, in the presence of my tape and radio over and over again. I sharpened it. I worked with friends. I got myself really ready. The only thing I forgot about was who the audience of the show really was. And when I saw that, most of them, were teenagers essentially, or very early 20s. At one point, I made a reference to Carol Chessman. David Letterman asked me how I felt after I'd done this, and I said that I felt a little like Carol Chessman. Well, if you knew that Carol Chessman had been, executed by the state of California, that's amusing, at least amusing. But no one there in the room had ever heard of Carol Chessman, because he happened before 1970. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I'm answering my question. At least one question is getting answered. Yes, it's tough when you really get up there and do it. It was scary. I mean, to start, and there are 10 million people, they say, or at least that's what they tell their advertisers, and you're standing up there doing 8 minutes of comedy in front of a hostile audience. I learned what it was like. It's very, very difficult, very, very difficult. I did all right, but certainly I'm glad I don't have to do it for a living. I'm glad I can write.
Is it something you'd ever want to try again?
Only because I'm, out of a sort of challenge and mad egotism. Yeah, I might like to do it again, but it would really be silly, I think. I know what that thing is. If I did it, I really would be open to kind of valid criticism of a kind of disproportionate egomania, to get up there. Because I'm not a stand-up comedian. If I was going to be one, I would have been one, before. Although I did see Rodney Dangerfield when he was beginning as the very earliest. He did a routine at a place called the Duplex in New York. I don't even know if it exists. And he was so tense and so terrible. And he went through at least 11 handkerchiefs. And I don't mean weeping, I mean sweating. And there were, nine tables of people sort of looking at this man writhing and sort of shadow boxing against his own failure. And it was really something you never forget, except then you turn around 3 years later and there he is on national television, much more accomplished, much more graceful, doing what he does very well. So.
Who were the comedians who you enjoyed when you were young?
Oh, well, the one I remember, I think I remember the Marx Brothers, Danny Kaye, who was an early model for Rupert in his softest incarnation, the kind of fantasist dreamer. That's always had a tremendous appeal for me, that kind of person who lives in his head, as Rupert does. And also Sid Caesar and that whole wild, wonderful stuff that came out of your show of shows and mine. It was just fabulous, that kind of flowering, all the writers. And the writers do count in comedy. They had Doc Simon and Woody Allen and Larry Gelbart and Mel Tolkien, who was Bob Hope's writer. Gelbart, of course, now best known for MASH. They had and Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks, the most probably prolific of that group and the craziest. And all in one show, and they had these incredible performers. Something I remember forever, and I'm just sorry it's gone. I wish that one could get hold. One of the things that Marty Scorsese has in his house, which is one of the pleasures, is that's just playing in the living room occasionally. You walk through his living room, and an old kinescope from your show of shows will be playing on one of his sets. Nobody will be watching. And it's just like what goes on in the film in Jerry Langford's home, that these screens are playing. I don't know what that means particularly, except it says something about isolation. But
do you have a lot of memories of putting on the TV, for the Ed Sullivan Show or something, and putting on, having a comic come on who you thought was really dreadful?
No, I just remember the good ones. It's funny. There was a woman named Madeline Carroll was her name. I don't know. I just remember terrible jokes but I thought they were funny about carrying elephant tusks through the jungle and then finding the elephants who were still attached, that kind of terrible humor. But when you're 10, almost everything's funny, I think.
One of the traits of Rupert Pupkin, who's the comedian who kidnaps Jerry Lewis in order to get on the show, is that in addition to being an aspiring comic, he's a real fan. That's he's a real obsessed fan who has memorabilia and cardboard cutouts of the people from the Jerry Langford show. And he imagines himself all the time being in that position of being a national television celebrity.
Being on with Jerry, too, that's very important with him. It's not just that he envisions himself, because there's a kind of hidden father-son thing going on all the way through that movie between them that was changed at the very end, but it's supposed to end with them reunited. It doesn't end with them. Without saying how it does end, they are not reunited, but there is a kind of father-son relationship that goes through. I don't know where you were on that, but
what did you do to find out what these really obsessed fans are like? Because I thought you captured, from what I know of obsessed fans, you've captured the language really well.
Well, I'll tell you what my research amounted to: 1 half-hour program and watching it of David Susskind and some autograph hunters, and the rest was out of my head and I guess out of myself, although I've never been that way. And I mean, I'm a great fan from a distance, but I never collected autographs that way. I don't know. It's nice to have an imagination. It saves you a lot of research in that way. And I was lucky on that one. I think I really did catch that kind of craziness. And what was interesting is that in the end, they started substituting real fans. Marty likes to use as many real people and non-actors. And so at the stage door, at least at the beginning, those were the genuine items, the ones who are trading human beings around. I'll give you a Barbara for a Robin Williams. I'll trade you even though that was the general idea of the scene as I wrote it, he put in real people who did that. And it worked just as well or the same.
The rumor I heard was that it was Johnny Carson who was first approached to play the late-night talk show host. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yeah.
And he turned it down?
Yeah, he turned it down, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is that he didn't want to play so close to himself if he was going to go through it. I think also he probably was a little frightened to play a part that demanding because, I mean, I was not pleased at first when I heard Jerry Lewis was going to be, because as a comedian, he was never a big favorite of mine after the age of 12.
After you were 12.
Not after the age. He was 12. I don't know what he did after that, except he wound up on television. But, and I thought, what kind of hero is this who worships the schmageggy, that kind of. But how Marty solved that, which was really brilliant, is he kept the mythic element of Lewis, the size, the importance, the kind of place that Lewis, who is a remarkable performer in a special way, just not somebody you can imagine being worshipped by someone, that particular kind of comedy. But we kept the myth, but he sheared off all the nonsense. So you never see the routine. He shot a videotaped thing of Lewis's comic routine, and you never even see it. He decided that he couldn't, and he also, you couldn't show that side of him and keep Langford, I think, as a figure worthy of worship, and therefore the hero worthy of caring about who worshipped him. But he did elicit from Lewis an incredible performance, and I think it will certainly get an Academy Award nomination, and it really has a fairly decent shot. The question is, how much money is the movie going to make? How long is it going to stay around? Is it going to count in the ultimate arena of critical consideration by the Academy, which is money? Because very rarely that movies that don't make money win anything, but putting that aside, he's got a very, very good shot at that, and it's extraordinary.
Yeah, I thought it was a really terrific performance. Have you spoken to any national talk show people like Johnny Carson who are worried now that they will be the victim of some kidnapping from
They've
someone
mentioned
who learned
it
the
themselves.
Trade from this?
They've mentioned it themselves, but it was, I think, a profound mistake about the way human nature works. Basically, it may happen. I'm not saying, but I would doubt that something like this wouldn't find an expression one way or another had the movie never been made. After all, the movie had never been made and Mark David Chapman shot John Lennon. And the movie had not been made and Hinckley went after Reagan. The movie, you have a tremendous number of instances of fans crossing the barrier, which Rupert does, between fantasy and reality and not even knowing he's crossing it. And so if another one does this, it's hard to say, is it cause and effect or is it prophecy? This movie had a prophetic, I mean, it's a very self-congratulatory characterization of it. I mean, to say, I wrote a screenplay that had a prophetic, but it did. I mean, you look at it, that's what it had. It sent something based also on Bremer's notes. I mean, Bremer had already done his thing to Wallace, and those notes were sort of interesting, that kind of close personal connection. But, I mean, I got this connection more. There was a piece in Esquire about a guy who would keep diaries of the talk show hosts and wrote about them as though they were his personal friends. And so putting together the Susskind show with the autograph hunters and my own idea of what would happen if one of these guys really thought one of these comedians was his friend and got a break, because then following this kind of fantasy that's mine of the underdog with nothing coming up from, that's what I write about a lot, sort of underdog stories, why I root for teams that are underdogs. That just appeals to me. I guess that's very American of me.
Do you root for the comic in this? For
my allegiance is much more with Rupert than it is with Langford, because I believe Langford commits the original sin, saying call my office. He really leads him to believe there's a certain passive abuse in that. It says to somebody as naive and believing in the American dream as Rupert, the answer to your question, is this my big break, Jerry, is yes, it is your big break, Rupert, and call my office. And then he just completely, you know, never feels any obligation. As nice as the show is, there is a kind of subtle abuse of power. It isn't even Langford's fault, maybe, personally. It's the way business is done. But at the end when he says, I told you to get rid of you, that's something I never put in the screenplay. I guess it's made more explicit. It really is a way of getting rid of Rupert for the millions of fans out there who don't know what we're talking about. Rupert wins a place in Jerry's limousine. Jerry comes out of the back door. His fans engulf him for reasons we don't have to go into right now. Rupert saves him from his fans, leads him to his limousine, and instead of closing the door, slips in and says, I'm sorry, you know, to trouble you, Jerry. I wouldn't bother you, but, you know, I'm really terrific, et cetera, et cetera, and asks for a favor in return, having earned one, having, you know. And Jerry says, call my office, and the movie starts on that premise. And Rupert never lets go of that little bone he's thrown. He worries it. Now, I have a kind of admiration for his stamina, because in the show business, as the English say, that's what ultimately determines who you see, who gets published, whose screenplays get on. And more times than not, it's not talent. It's that kind of dogged, indefatigable, you know, stamina, resilience, staying power, to be told 8 million times you stink and you're no good and nobody wants you in nice ways. Of course, they never say that, to say it's the best thing they've ever read, or it's, oh, you do a wonderful act in this, but it's just not right. But to be able to hear that, you know, literally 400 or 500 times in a row and bounce up again like the beach clown, to be hit down and come back and say, no, I don't accept that. I won't accept that. And that's what he does. And I admire that in him. And I admire that in me. And I admire it in anybody. It takes a lot of stupidity or stubbornness or whatever it is. It takes something that's hard and admirable in a person to hang in there.
Do you think the comedian in the movie has the talent to back up the persistence?
No. No, I don't think he's really good. But my God, if we limited television to people who are really good, what would they put on the screen? Really, you think of it. How much is really good on the screen? How much is real talent at work? 10%? That's a fairly generous assessment. It's not talent's fault. Talent is, I mean, how can you fill 40 channels with all the cables and whatever, an average of 10 hours a day? That's 4,000 hours, let's just say, 4,000 hours a day. How much, there isn't enough talent in the world to fill a tenth of that. So you don't have to be talented to get on, but you do have to have something else. You have to have mastered a formula. I mean, that's what most of those sort of sitcoms are.
So as a screenwriter, do you have to ask yourself, will I be inspiring people to kidnap variety show hosts so that they can
No, as interviewers, you have to ask people who've written that, do you think you're inspired? But I don't think it's the job of the artist. I think it's the job of the journalist to ask that question. I think that's a very valid question from a journalist. I think from somebody who's making up something. I mean, my God, what you're really saying, I think that King of Comedy is one of the best. I didn't shoot it, so I could hate it too. But I think it's one of the best movies in the last few years. And to say, well, gee, you ought not to make that movie because it might put Johnny in danger. I mean, that's a pretty strange set of values, isn't it? I mean, should we just stop doing anything that puts Johnny and Merv and Dick and, you know, and Donahue and Mike Douglas? I mean, how would you like to go to Buñuel as a script and you say, gee, that's a great script, like, or to Marty Scorsese and say, but it's going to put Mike Douglas in some trouble. We're afraid Mike's going to be kidnapped, so you can't make that movie. I just don't believe in those values. I mean, I could see someone else believing in them. But I think it's worth risking Merv for a good movie. In fact, I'd be willing to do it right now. Wouldn't you trade Merv for a really good day at the movies? There aren't so many of them. There are lots of Mervs, but how many good movies are there?
Did you watch a lot of TV before or watch?
Oh, yeah. I watched a lot of comedy and sports. It seemed to me, looking back, that there was more good comedy on TV than there is now. I mean, I used to watch Ernie Kovacs every night. To me, that was thrilling, the kind of wild, daring craziness. Monty Python, as a so-called adult, you know, as someone who has to at least play those prices at the movies, I used to rush back and watch Monty Python, and I would gladly now, to anybody who has a full set of Monty Python, buy those on VCR. Please call Terry Gross and... I know, but seriously, I mean, that's one thing. I think that's fabulous, that kind of stuff. But you don't see much of it anymore. All the comedy now is quite tame and homogenized and safe. But when I was growing up, I used to love that stuff, and I remember it best. Why I remember comedy best, I have no idea, but I remember jokes. I don't remember, for example, living at a certain apartment with my father for a year of my life. Really, literally don't remember that. I was told about it a few years ago. It was as though it was somebody else. I was 6 to 7. I don't remember that. But I remember some of the movies at the Laugh Riot, with the Ritz brothers, the Marx brothers. Now, that just shows you how strange people are, or me, or anybody, the kind of selectivity of memory. And it's always mattered a lot to me. Comedy is always, it's the way to answer the injustices of the world. It's the answer to all the crap in the world is humor. It's the ammunition that I can use when it works. I'm not always funny. Boy, there are a lot of times when I'm not. But real humor comes for me out of a real anger, out of a real sense that something's not fair, that something's not right, maybe even from a spoiled part of myself. But it's an attempt to redress the balance somehow.
Let me reintroduce you. Paul Zimmerman's my guest, and he wrote the screenplay for King of Comedy, which is now playing in Philadelphia and will be the opening film at the Cannes Film Festival, which starts on May 7th. And Paul Zimmerman, in the 1970s, was a film critic for Newsweek. Was there a lot of tension on the set between De Niro and Jerry Lewis that carried over into the film?
No, it's interesting you would ask that because it worked a different way. Lewis and De Niro got along fine. Lewis got along with everybody. I think he was on his best behavior because he's getting older, and he respected Bobby and Marty. And this was his shot at respectability. And if you've ever been the funny guy, you know that the funny guy wants respectability, wants respect. I mean, it's that Rodney Dangerfield cry is really true of all the class clowns that ever were, you know? They get the laughs, but everybody else gets elected class president, most likely to succeed, best. And this was Jerry Lewis's chance, I think. And I think he recognized he's not stupid by any means, quite an intelligent actor, as you see. And he had the confidence that he wouldn't look stupid, and he knew this was his chance for a kind of American legitimacy. And so he behaved very well. The way Marty dealt with him, as he dealt in all this, is he tries to create, through filming very often, the mood of the scene. So there is a scene, Lewis did not like being kidnapped. He didn't like playing somebody being kidnapped. And to get he's being held at gunpoint at one point by De Niro, although the gun is, you know, a toy gun, he doesn't know it, Lewis. And what Marty would do is have them shoot it over and over and over again until Lewis, the person, was unable to get away in the way that Langford, the character, was unable to get away. So what Marty did is use the pistol of his authority, pointed it at Lewis's head endlessly, taking take after take after take, and Lewis would seethe and get more and more angry and yet couldn't object until finally he got to the point where he could barely stand it. And on that take, he kept it. And he got a man who barely could stand the situation he was in saying the lines that were supposed to be said, but about something else. And that was the way that another thing was interesting. Marty never said that's no good. He'd always said that's good. Let's do it again. And the way he gets the best out of people is he gives them tremendous amount of respect, all of them. And they, being respected, respond a lot better than people are told that's not adequate, I don't like this. And there's a lesson in that for all of us, even you, Terry.
Oh, well, do you think it's a good way of directing to get people to? It seems in a way like it's cheating because you're not really reacting on their, you're not really relying on their acting skills. You're manipulating them as a person to get them to show the kind of action that you want.
I don't know. I just find the performances in Scorsese films are wonderful. And the performances in other films are generally less wonderful. And so it's very tough to sit in judgment on Marty and say, gee, you got wonderful performances from everyone in that movie, but the way you did it is really open to question. Now, if you'd only do it more properly, we could get a few duller performances with a little less vitality in them, but they'd be more moral. I don't want to be in that position. I don't think you do. And I mean, you didn't kill him. He didn't electrocute him. It isn't as though, you know, he to get somebody who'd been wounded, he hit them over the head with a bat. He used his situation. I think it's very clever, not particularly nice, but it's, you know, you're dealing with things that are more important than nice and more important, just as they're more important than Johnny and Merv. I mean, if you take your art seriously.
Could you compare how Jerry Lewis reacts to his public with the way Jerry Langford, the talk show host who you created, who Lewis plays, reacts to his public?
Well, I think in some ways it's a kind of funny difference. You see it in the film. Lewis, I think that walk that he took is probably...
Do you want to describe that for me?
Well, he walks across town. And he's fairly... I mean, I think he likes that to a certain extent. I mean, I don't know. I didn't see him around a lot of people. So I'm not in a good position, but it's my guess that he caught both sides of him, the side that can't, you know, that really isn't basically terribly friendly, and the other side that needs his public. I think that all the stars have this funny kind of ambivalence. You know, they hate that invasion, that constant pressure, that goldfish bowl, but boy, if it ever stops, they're panicked. Although, on the other hand, De Niro never has any of it. What's more interesting is I walk with De Niro. We would come from the shooting and we walk to the hotel and talk about things. And no one ever recognized him at all, and he loved it. He really doesn't want that. He's not like Woody Allen who says, oh, I hate my public, let's go eat at Elaine's. He really doesn't go eat at Elaine's, and he really doesn't want that public, and he really means it. And he really is an artist who's private and who saves his energy for his roles, which is really quite admirable. I have a great admiration for him, and it's not by luck that he's the most talented actor of his generation. It's by that kind of almost monastic dedication.
Do you know what he did to prepare for the role of the aspiring comedian?
Well, he went to a lot of comedy clubs, lots of them, and I imagine he read a lot. I can only tell you from my point of view, it's a kind of nice story. I talked to him. You go in the trailer. And we would talk during, because there's enormous hours of boredom, you know, in between shooting. It takes hours to set up the lights, even for the smallest change. And he said, you know, just as he was starting out, he said, could you give me some character pages? I said, all right. I said, you got a novelization I wrote, which is about 300 pages, and you have the script. But you want some character pages, which is just talking about Rupert. So I sat down, I did 8 single-spaced character pages, and I came back with them at another visit to the set, and he said, great. And then he said, give me 8 more. You know, give me some more. And I said, hey, I have nothing left. You know, I gave you this and this, and it's equivalent of, you know, at least 16 normal pages. He said, no, you can. So I went away, and I said, okay, I will. And I went through the entire screenplay, and I wrote what was going through Rupert's mind at every moment during the screenplay, and that came out to another 8 single-spaced pages. You know, notes, careful. Okay. I gave it to him. He said, that's good. Saw him a couple of days. Give me another bunch of pages. I said, you bloodsucker, you vampire. I don't have any more left in me. Leave me alone, you know. You got enough. And he said, please. And I said, we'll see. So I went back to the set, and I'd come in and out when they needed some writing done and stuff. And we were chatting in the trailer, and I thought he'd forgotten. And just as I was about to leave, he said, "Hey, you never sent me those pages." I said, "Oh, come on." He said, "I want those pages." And I sat down, and by God, he was right. I came up with 8 more single-spaced pages. I don't even remember what they were. They were like the pulp and pit and, you know, and peel of the orange when all the juice had been. And the strange, wonderful thing is you see it in his performance, things that you wrote. The fact that he walks with his head tilted slightly forward, as there was in the character notes, always looking towards the future because that's the kind of character Rupert is, that he had white bucks on, those silly white shoes in some of the scenes, which are just little things like that, little kindnesses that Rupert does that he picked up and managed to just weave in. He's like an enormous sponge, De Niro. He just soaks up. He just sits there for months before and during a role, soaking it up, I think, and putting it into this huge storehouse of his unconscious. And then he draws on that. You have that feeling of an unused unconscious or a great deal of unused stuff behind the used stuff that you had with Brando. There are very few actors that act out of that tremendous sort of unconscious is all. I mean, Hoffman isn't that way. He's a wonderful actor, but you have a great specificity and intelligence working, but you get the feeling everything is used in Hoffman. But in Brando and De Niro, you have the sense of an unused self of enormous proportions out of which this character is sculpted, is molded in enormous detail, and it's wonderful to watch it.
What are some of the questions he asked you about the character? In addition to asking you for all the pages?
He didn't ask questions. He just used. He didn't say, would he do this? Would he? Although he would, I remember, which is kind of nice about him. They called me in for, it's silly to show the detail. They needed some proof for Rupert to show the people on the talk show that he had Langford. And I remember this handkerchief from the first scene where Rupert saves Jerry. There's a little blood on, and Jerry gives him the, he keeps Jerry's handkerchief. So he has that as proof. And Freddie DeCordova, who is the real producer of The Tonight Show, who plays the producer of the Jerry Langford show, he hands him the handkerchief and he says, that's Jerry's, he said. And he says, what about this? And he shows the blood. And he says, that's my blood, he said the first time. And afterwards he came up to me, he said, how is that? Which is very unusual for an actor. And I said, no, that isn't it. You said, no, that's Jerry's handkerchief. But that's my blood. And he said it the second time with the emphasis. And it was only on a later project with Stanley Donen where I put down, he says, gaily or this and that. He said, actors hate any kind of, they normally hate that kind. But here was a guy who has none of that ego. Coming to, it could have been somebody else. It came to me, I'm very, you know, pleased I wrote it, you know. They're saying, what about that? You know, and most people would have known more than to give him a reading. You're not supposed to give a reading to a great actor. But he didn't. He said, oh, good. And he has no ego that way. And it's wonderful. It's such a wonderful thing. And Scorsese said to me, once we were at his apartment, he said, you know, people ask me, why do I make all these films with Bobby? Why with Bobby, you know? He said, Pacino's a wonderful actor. Hoffman's a wonderful actor. But why should I have to take their nonsense when I have the best and we understand each other? And I see what he means. Of course, the answer is because Dustin Hoffman can play other roles that Bobby De Niro really can't. Family men, domesticated people, you know, that's a different. But the fact is, Marty Scorsese doesn't want to shoot films about those people anyway.
Do you think De Niro couldn't play a family man? Because he certainly hasn't. All the characters who he's played have been really obsessives.
I don't know. We really won't know till he decides to play one, but he's never played a normative character. He's always played an outsider. He's always played a basically sexless character in some way, too. A basically asexual or pent-up kind of outsider. Even in Deer Hunter, his relationship with Meryl Streep, the sexuality there is very strange and impacted, and he's very sealed in. He plays a priest, you know, and while he himself is aware of a lot of sort of pornographic goings-on, and he himself is held back and sealed in, and that's the kind of character Bobby likes to play. And I mean, it's just very hard. I think it's hard for him then to play anything else because he, as most stars, they start collecting a persona that becomes irreversible. And as much flexibility as he has within a certain range, he has a kind of type, too. People say, oh, Bobby plays one day. He's so different in every role. He's so different in every role, and yet the role shares so much in common with other characters that he plays.
Are those traits that you think he has in person?
Well, he's very quiet. He's a very quiet, private person. I've spent some time with him. I don't pretend to know him. He seems like a very fair, sensitive, quiet person, but I can't pretend to say I know him. I mean, you know, I really don't know him. In some ways, you know Marty better. Very high-geared, tense sort of, but much more of Marty is on the outside, and yet neither of them. They are, what makes them such great artists is they save it for their work. Their personality comes through what they do, not how they talk at the table or when you're out at a party with them. It's like all of show business. That's what makes those people interesting. That's what's so false about the world of the Rupert Pupkins and the fans and is that they're chasing the uninteresting parts of the people. The parts that are really wonderful about them are accessible to everybody. That's why we have movies, you know? That's where they're wonderful. They're not wonderful at the table. They're perfectly okay, and some of them are swine, and some of them are nice. But none of them is worth getting their name on a piece of paper for. This, you know, and I can't say I'm immune. I mean, I feel good that I know them. I feel privileged. I feel flattered. I drop their name. You know, maybe it's appropriate here, but I can't say that I don't know the certain effect that it makes. I mean, we're all vulnerable to that, but I can tell you here that there's nothing so wonderful about De Niro in private as they're in the screen. He's one of the great actors of his generation. What does it mean to be one of the great private people of your generation? You know, that's meaningless. So, I mean, while there's a lot of curiosity and it's legitimate, I would say on some level, every wonderful performer is a disappointment and should be, because you can't live at that level of creativity and you shouldn't have to. And nobody should expect it of you. I mean, that's what's so false about People magazine, is it try and all these things, and these up close and personal. What they're really doing is getting up close and personal to the persona that's projected in the films. They're not getting personal Barbara Walters. It's a joke. They don't know the real anybody. You want to be real in front of 81 million people on prime time? Those people are career performers. So they just put on another performance, and everybody thinks they're watching the real. It's ridiculous. And I won't stand for it.
Were you thinking about all of this as you were writing?
No.
Because it seems to me everything you've just said ties in perfectly.
I thought about it afterwards. I thought about what happens next. That's what I thought about. That's the way you write something. What can he do? What's interesting? What's exciting? What would happen if he this? No, I don't think, I think, boy, you start conceptualizing and you're dead. Conceptualizing is wonderful fun afterwards. But it's not a creative thing.
Did you read your reviews?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I thought they were terrific. I was thrilled, and I even liked the Pauline Kael review in a certain way. I was glad we got somebody upset. You know, I don't like art that's safe, that everybody, like E.T., which is a nice movie, everybody loved it. Well, almost everybody loved King of Comedy, but there were enough people who hated it to give it validity.
Can you explain the marketing strategy behind the release of King of Comedy? I was one of the people who was like really waiting for the movie to come out, and it opened in like New York and Los Angeles
and five other cities. Let me tell you, let me answer what I think happened, okay? Because it opened in New York and Los Angeles and a few other cities, and they opened it in the other cities to find out how it would play naked in Tulsa, in Phoenix, in Toronto, and Dallas. And what they found out is that it broke the house record in New York. It did reasonably well, but not fabulously in L.A., and it didn't do very well in the other places. And as this has been explained to me by people at Fox who asked to be nameless, they decided it wasn't going to be The Return of the Jedi, it wasn't going to be E.T., and they more or less wrote it off. Yes, they in places where it broke the bank, like Chicago and Boston, they would open it at 7 theaters, not at 37. It never went wide, and they sort of dribbled along with it. They lost all the momentum they had from this fabulous reviews it got, and I don't know why it reached Philadelphia so late. I tried to ask the people. They don't know in Philadelphia. I mean, it's, you know, I can't explain it. It's a very special movie, and it's a movie for people who really like something serious in their entertainment, something that says something in their entertainment. It is not Spring Break. It is not, you know, the kind of frivolous movie, and maybe it would never have made enormous amounts of money. It's done remarkably well in the big, serious cities of this country, but it's gotten precious little help. It's expensive advertising movies. Maybe Fox felt that they didn't want to put the money in because they might lose it. Maybe it had something to do with the fact that the people who oversaw and loved and believed in this movie left Fox. And a new regime came in, and very often that regime really doesn't do much for the movies and therefore the reputations of their predecessors. But I'm very pleased with it, and I think it's a movie that's going to be around longer than I am, and who could want more than that?
Have you done any interviews on the kinds of national shows that are alluded to in the movie? You did Letterman.
No, none of the others. They don't want writers. They want the stars. Writers aren't, you know, who wants writers? I mean, writers only make up what the movie's about, you know. Why bother with them?
One of the things that people always argue about is whether something that happens in the movie is the responsibility of the writer or the director, like who really put it in there. Are people reading it right with King of Comedy in their assessment of what Scorsese put in, what you put in?
I don't know. Some people are. I mean, I can tell you what it is the story is mine. You know, the story is the story I wrote. The characters are basically the characters I invented, although with changes in the casting that changes them somewhat substantially. But the tone, the mood, the choices, the emphasis, the colors, it is a Martin Scorsese film. That's not. It's a Martin Scorsese film of a Bob De Niro, Jerry Lewis performance of a story written by Paul Zimmerman. Nobody wrote any of the words, and improvised moderately by some characters, not at all by others. Does that tell you what? I mean, nobody wrote when they wanted something. I wrote it, but a lot of what a movie is not in the writing, and yet it can't be there without it. It's one of those.
If you're still writing film criticism, do you think you'd be writing any differently, having had the experience now of making a movie?
Yes. My instincts tell me I would. I've learned a lot more about the pressures on a film and how tough it is, and I think I'm more sophisticated about it, a lot more sophisticated than I was. And I'd probably be a little better critic. I'm not so sure I'd be a little better critic because in the sense that I wrote before, I was much more in the shoes of the audience, which is, after all, who you're writing for. And I'm not so sure that really I know too much or my emphasis, I don't think you can know too much, but my emphasis wouldn't be too businessy and I wouldn't be, it would be different. It would be different. I really haven't given it much thought because I don't have much interest in writing criticism again. I did that and it was a wonderful way to make a living, but... I want to write more movies and either direct them or write novels and make sure that my own vision gets out there with all its warts and the rest of it. And that's plenty to do in an 8-hour day.
What are the projects you have coming up?
Well, I'm in the middle of writing a book about a nuclear protester in spite of himself, about a fellow who is vaulted by coincidence to the forefront of a national movement he doesn't understand the first thing about. And it allows, from that point of view, a lot of comedy into the whole question of commitment and the rest of it and human nature, and I'm having a good time with it. And when I get back from the Cannes Film Festival, I will resume it. And it's the only problem with novels is they take about 150 times longer than screenplays and pay about 150th what those do. So it's a real kind of investment of my time, but I think that if I can make it work, at least that book will be my version of my story rather than somebody else's version of my story. And that's, you know, after all, you only go around 2 or 3 times. And, you know, it's nice to have your own version of your own story up there as brilliantly as Marty did it. I mean, I'd be less than human if I didn't sort of regret that it wasn't all the way I imagined it.
Have you been going to the movie theaters in different neighborhoods where King of Comedy is showing to see how the audiences react?
I did that when I was new. I haven't done that out here. I don't know why. I mean, I've seen audiences react. I will see it when I go to Cannes. And I always sort of hoped that I'd see it at some of my neighborhood theaters. But I've seen enough of it. I don't know. I guess I'm too busy. I've seen it, and it's wonderful to sit. I went the first night, the opening night in New York, to The Late Show, which was sold out at the Carnot Theater. And Marty and I and my wife and the publicist stood in the back and listened to the laughter ripple over. And it really is, it's like the ultimate ultimate sauna, or, you know, it's just a wonderful thing, that moment that you dream of people laughing and appreciating what you sweated over for so long. It was thrilling, and during that, Rupert Pupkin came up to Marty and said, I have a film, I want to get this thing done. So, you know, I mean, it was being validated in the back of the theater while it was showing. It was a very strange thing, and Marty said to him, call my office. So, I mean, life imitates art, imitates life. It's a very peculiar kind of thing, but yeah.
Say somebody called you as soon as this interview was over and said, I have a screenplay. I'm sure you're going to love it. I saw King of Comedy, and I know this is going to be right up your alley, and you can really help me get an agent. What would you say to them?
I'd read it. I'd read it, and I know somebody to send it to, and I'd send it. But I don't invite those kind of things. There has to be some kind of personal connection. There's somebody I know, you know, and you know, even if it's just the brother of a kid who goes to school with my kids, you know. And then I'll read it, and you know, I'm in there helping aspiring talent. I'm not a cold-hearted, terrible person. I'll give a kid a break, you know, but you do have to limit it. There are things that, you know, I'd like to work on my kind of political action after I'm done rather than on somebody else's career. Mm-hmm. So it's a question of priorities. We all face it. Even you face it, don't you, Terry? Come on, you can tell all. Tell everybody. You have.
Oh, well, gee, there's not going to be time. Anyways, I love the movie, and I'm really glad.
Well, it only reaffirms my high opinion of you.
I'm really glad you were able to come back.
Me too.
For the interview, and have a great trip to Cannes.
Thank you.
It's really exciting, it being the opening film. It's a real
tribute. I find
it
exciting.
Yeah. So good luck at the Cannes Film Festival.
Thank you very much.
Paul Zimmerman has been my guest, and he lives in Bucks County, where he's active in the nuclear freeze movement. He wrote the screenplay for King of Comedy, which is now playing at theaters around Philadelphia and in Center City. And that movie will be opening the Cannes Film Festival, and the festival begins May 7th. And
so get your plane tickets now.
That's right. Hurry up. And King of Comedy stars are Robert De Niro and Jerry Lewis, directed by Martin Scorsese. Well, that's about it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. It's 3 minutes to 5 o'clock. All Things Considered is coming up at 5. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air in just a minute, but let's check in first with Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Major highways look pretty good so far. The only slow spot on the Schuylkill Expressway is westbound at City Line Avenue. No major problems on the Roosevelt Extension. I-95 northbound slows for about a half a mile approaching the Ray Street merger. And the Platte Detour Road slow for about a half a mile approaching Island. Now, westbound University Avenue's 34th Street bridge is blocked at Gray's Ferry due to an overturned crane in the process of being cleared. And SEPTA's Route 13 trolley running buses between 49th and Chester and the end of the line due to an earlier accident at 56th and Chester. Tacony-Palmyra Bridge scheduled for a 7:15 opening, and the New Jersey Turnpike has a trailer ban the entire length due to high winds. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
That Shadow Traffic report was funded with a grant by Wilkie Buick Subaru. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by sculptor Richard Fleischner, who has an installation on display at the Philadelphia College of Art. At 3:20, we'll be hearing from one of the Muppets designers, the woman who designed Miss Piggy, and she also designed the Philly Fanatic, the mascot of the Phillies. At 3:40, Ken Tucker in Hearing Secret Harmonies, our weekly rock review. At 4 o'clock, I'll be speaking with Alan Berube, who will be discussing a history of gays in the military during World War II. In the March issue of Mother Jones, his was the cover story, doing a history of gays in the Second World War. At 4:30, we'll be joined by Mel Dahl, who's a sailor who was recently discharged from the Navy for being gay, and he's currently fighting that through the courts. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. Fred Snyder was the technical director for today's show. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller is the co-producer of the program. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening. I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered, coming up live from Washington, D.C. Have a good evening.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm David Malpas.
And I'm Susan Stamberg, with All Things Considered.
It would be Pollyannish not to think that a major reason President Reagan nominated Mr. Ruckelshaus was for a favorable public image.
One of the witnesses at confirmation hearings for the proposed new head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Tonight on All Things Considered, environmentalists remain skeptical that the agency will be as tough as it ought to be.
Also tonight, Californians, shaken by yesterday's earthquake, begin to clean up the rubble.
Movement on arms control. The Soviets offer to reduce some intermediate-range nuclear warheads.
Poland rejects the Pope's call for release of political prisoners.
A former official of Solidarity explains how the outlawed organization operates underground.
That and more on All Things Considered. First, this news.
This is Brian Naylor. Soviet leader Yuri Andropov today outlined a change in his country's position on the reduction of nuclear weapons. Andropov proposed reducing the number of warheads, not just missiles, aimed at Western Europe. From Moscow, Jan Luzowski reports.
Mr. Andropov said that when Moscow expressed a willingness to reduce its medium-range arsenal in Europe to the level of British and French nuclear weapons, it was told that there would still be an imbalance in the number of warheads. The Soviet Union's SS-20...